Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. Prominent investor Jeremy Grantham describes modern civilization as an opportunity to live like royalty of centuries past. He details our ability to drive 200 horsepower chariots hundreds of miles daily and think nothing of it, purely due to a loss of perspective. That type of undertaking a few hundred years back would have taken days and meticulous planning and execution. We now take for granted a semi-truck can move our stuff 3,000 miles across country in less than a week, a feat that once would have taken a vast wagon train, dozens of people, and a year's time frame. Now, that's given happens in a consistent loop on an ongoing basis. And with food, well, that's a whole different story. Now it's just come from the grocery store, doesn't it? You just have to show up and access a cornucopia of fresh global offerings everywhere. But in recent years, we've begun to realize that some of those unintended consequences with every day and everyone living like royalty, well, there's externalities that have yet to be realized with this approach. Having billions living like kings is putting a tax on future generations that will increasingly prove concerning on human and planetary health. That pendulum has swung so far out of balance, we ask, what comes next? The tax for the majority of Americans on those driving the one-ton chariots, now an emergence of hot, flat, and crowded planet, as Tom Friedman say. This has seemed to incur a citizen's awakening throughout the country. But one of the areas, returning back to food, that hasn't been realized as a tax in the same limelight as emissions is the impact on the bounty of that cheap food is having on our planet and the folks producing and harvesting our sustenance. The average foodstuff in the U.S. travels about 1,800 miles, and often it comes from a never-never land of production, or worse, to many, it comes from those mystical grocery or meal delivery providers. With the loss of understanding from where our food comes from, we've compromised our appreciation for hard work and the skills needed to produce this bounty. Unknowingly, we've become guilty of treating the labor force producing this cheap food inhumanely. Effectively, our modern agricultural and food system sourcing cheap food is subsidized on the backs of migrant workers who, in many cases, are one pay grade higher than slave labor. According to a few statistics I found, the percentage of U.S. farm workers that were undocumented ranges from 53 to 62%. Now we must ask, if not for this invisible domestic workforce, who's going to produce our food? It's somewhat of an out of sight, out of mind. And on this, on food, isolated in golden towers behind the protective walls of a modern Rome, devouring fast food and drinking 8 Diet Cokes a day, we have a short-sighted leader expressing his questionable morals on the rest of us. I know for a fact that most folks in this country are compassionate and good people who are just unaware of the impact of their food choices. A backlash is being seen in real time, where the jailing of families in the southern border have us all questioning who we are. If nothing more, for those fat cats of royalty in those golden towers, if you jail your migrant workers, who the hell is going to subsidize those thrice daily Big Macs? Our guest today is a longtime advocate of better food, of equal rights. She's a dogged supporter of local food movement for farm workers and in providing access to nutrition for more U.S. families. She has just returned from a visit to the southern border and seen firsthand what's happening with these modern-day internment camps of many of the agricultural workers and their kids. Today we welcome Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. Hey, Shelley, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. So, Shelley, could you tell us what you saw down on the border and what can we do about it now?
Well, unfortunately, on our trip to the border, I think that we saw everything that we had heard about or been told about, and it was all as bad as we had heard and in some places worse. We make it incredibly difficult for people right now to attempt to come into this country and seek out asylum. People are coming really running for their lives from some very dangerous places. Even the people who are attempting to cross legally, we stop them at the border and delay them as long as we can. We detain them once they get in. And we are absolutely, and we have been taking children away from their parents, sometimes without even giving the parents a chance to say goodbye. And now that there has been a decision to reunite the families, what we're seeing is total inability on the part of the administration to make those connections. And that's one of the things that was clear to us, was that it was completely disorganized. It was inhumane treatment. There was no clear way to see how the children that we saw in one place were going to be reunited with the parents being held in detention in other places. And it's really discouraging to see this done in our name as American citizens. My grandfather was an immigrant to this country. Most of us started not that long ago as immigrants. And we are a country who's really based a lot of our economy on the backs of people who immigrate to this country and are willing to work very hard to do it. So the thing I think that I found most discouraging is there's so much myth around, you know, this debate right now. We're being told, oh, everyone comes in illegally and they're hardened criminals and they add nothing to our country and only cost a lot. And the reality is very different, just very different. And we need many of those workers. And you mentioned farm workers, and that's one part of our economy that really depends on people coming here and doing the work that we can't always find the workers to do.
Did you go down with a bipartisan party, or who went down with you, and what was the overall consensus of the leadership that went down to take a look at this?
I went with a group of about 30 members of Congress, I think just under 30. My group wasn't bipartisan. It was Democrats. It was members of the House from all over the country. There have been groups of Republicans, groups of senators, groups of House members. It's been pretty regular now that members of Congress from both parties are either going down to the border crossings or they're going to facilities in their districts where immigrants are being detained or children are being kept separated from their parents. Our mission, I think, was really just to better understand everything that we were hearing about and, frankly, find out if it was as bad as we thought, and also to come back and look for ways to at least enhance the dialogue, but hopefully push on legislation that might further stop this, that might force the reunification of families, that might provide us with more information. I think one of the biggest difficulties that both Republicans and Democrats have been experiencing is we're not allowed into a lot of the facilities. And these are members of Congress who have maybe detention going on in their home district, maybe detention of you know, small children, and they're not allowed in to see. And, you know, this is Congress has an oversight role of how the money is spent. And we have had at least one amendment in the House that got bipartisan support that basically said, you know, no facility can block members of Congress from visiting, yet that's continuing to happen. Sometimes even after the, you know, Republican member has provided, you know, a week's notice and met with every possible criteria, I guess, you know, we're all saying what is there to hide. Basically, we need very serious and comprehensive immigration reform, and that's how most of us felt when we came back. But we have an administration who's really been moving in the opposite direction, and I'm in the House, and unfortunately, the House leadership, Republican leadership, has not allowed us to bring any bipartisan positive bills to the floor. I mean, we have enough votes with Republicans and Democrats to pass immigration reform and to fix some of the problems that are going on at the border. But, you know, the way Congress works, whatever party is majority decides what to bring to the floor. And the most conservative Republicans in the House are blocking the moderate Republicans in the House from taking this up. So it's a frustrating situation. And I feel it's been so politicized. It's just really hard to move forward and fix the problem. And most of us in our home states are feeling some ramification of the problem, whether it's asylum seekers in our own state who are not being processed properly, or businesses who are dependent on laborers and can't get them because the quarters have been taken down or people aren't being allowed across or families that can't reunify. It's really a growing problem that gets worse every day.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I understand it's the very conservative House members that are really preventing this to come to vote. But, you know, the pragmatic appeal that if you have 50% plus of your workforce and one of your largest part of your GDP, how can you justify that you're not going to impact what you're supposed to be representing, which is fiscally savvy bills, fiscally savvy legislation?
Yeah, it's a quandary to me because this is an area where, for instance, the Chamber of Commerce is very actively engaged in promoting immigration reform. I think there's a strong understanding on the part of businesses in this country and agriculture in this country that we depend on immigrants to do the work. I mean, I come from the state of Maine, and we have a declining population. We are actually the oldest state in the nation. We have a real shortage of workers throughout our economy. And, you know, I think we're completely confused about why this Republican administration is blocking the ability to get more workers and why the conservatives in the House. We have agricultural workers that come to our state, a lot of people who do seasonal work, but also we have a tourism industry, and we've been really impacted in the last 2 or 3 years in what's called H-2B visas. That's what the seasonal workers who come to work in hotels, restaurants, you know, many of them return year after year after year. They're almost like family to the facilities that they work in. And the quotas have been cut. Returning workers no longer have an exemption. And I'm constantly having meetings with, you know, the restaurant association or hotel association, and I'm actually in their business, and they're very bipartisan, but they're just kind of shocked that the roadblock for them getting workers or having a healthy tourism season is the conservatives and the Republican Party. I think they, you know, kind of can't believe that this is going on and that it doesn't make any economic sense, and it's really detrimental in a state like mine.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty interesting, might be a clean way of saying it, because lots of leaping before looking, or really, again, if you're supposed to be the fiscally savvy group, without figuring out things like tariffs, which I know affect your state heavily with the $400 million lobster industry. And from what I've read, those tariffs will have an effect on the lobster and what they're going to receive for international export, 75 cents on the dollar what they were prior.
Yeah, lobstermen and lobster dealers in our state are profoundly concerned right now. We already had an issue because the Canadians are exempted from the tariff and shipping to Europe, which is a major market for us. And, you know, the Canadian border and the Maine border were right side by side. The lobsters cross without any thought about which country they're in. And frankly, we do a lot of joint processing. But now what's going on, because we don't have an agreement with the EU, and Canada does, the tariff is detrimental to us, which is, you know, a huge problem for us going into the lobster season right now. And then these new tariffs with China only compound the problem. And again, there's no, you know, we've had multiple meetings as a delegation, the congressional delegation with with the trade representatives, and, you know, they nod and say, yeah, we see you have a serious problem, but there's absolutely no resolution to it. And we have a feeling that the tariffs that are being imposed on these other countries, and then the ones that are coming back on us, that are from our side, the American side, it's just chaotic, that the administration doesn't really have a long-term plan, that they don't, you know, it's kind of arbitrary what they're doing. They have no real sense of how certain industries will be impacted. And for where lobstering is our most significant fisheries, and it's a short season and you can't make it up. It's a perishable product. It's not something we can just, you know, put in storage and, you know, have our live lobster sit around and wait till February when something is resolved. And our fishermen already have a lot of concerns. We have ocean temperatures rising and ocean acidification on their minds, and, you know, very unpredictable fishing going into the future. And this this is really just adding to the concerns out there. And again, you know, another difficulty of working with an administration that, you know, we'd like to think would be, would have a better understanding of business and agricultural and fishing related issues.
Yeah, it's like a Seinfeld episode. You have to step back and say, serenity now, right? I'm sure you take many, many moments to take a deep breath, right? So, you know, let's look positively. I want to talk about some, because I think what you've done has been a breath of fresh air. What you've done for Maine, what you've done at a federal level, incredible stuff. And I love going to Maine. My in-laws live up in Kennebunk. We go up there often, even starting a decade ago with your microbrew initiative, which, you know, helped culminate a food scene in Portland, which is just a phenomenal food city at this point. And personally, you know, I love beer. I had to take a step back purely because I'm now 43 years old, and man, those good IPAs just put weight on. My daughter took a took a photo of me without my shirt. I was running up to the car to put a shirt. I looked like I had a fat suit on, so I had to take a step back and be like, okay, I'm gonna cut back on my IPAs. But I enjoy all of your great bounty of food. So you represent Maine's first district for almost a decade. You serve currently on the Committee of Appropriations, the Subcommittee of Agriculture, and also the Interior and the Environment. So let's discuss what's going on in our regional food system development in the Northeast and how we could possibly be a model to scale out other regional instances of success. So whether we're looking at progressive regenerative agriculture, responsible fisheries and ocean farms, the connection of food and its impact on the environment, and or just teaching your constituents the value of good food and the impact on their health, Maine seems to be like a ground zero here for a food revolution. So could you share with our audience some of the exciting things happening in the Maine food ecosystem?
Well, thank you. I'd love to, and I am very happy that you have a good reason to visit Maine frequently, because you can't beat, as you said, coming to Maine for a great meal or a great beer, even if you have to cut back on that. Now we have a lot of distilleries coming in Maine, so maybe there are some
you know,
less caloric. Maybe you just stick with the vodka and you'll be okay.
Efficiency.
Exactly. I just feel really fortunate that I have the privilege of representing half of the state of Maine, and having served on the Agriculture Committee and now being on the Agriculture Appropriations Committee, getting to work on these issues at a federal level. It is really great to have the examples of the state of Maine to take to working on public policy, because we have been in the right place, right time, I think. And I spend a little bit of time trying to figure out exactly why that is. I think some of it has to do with the fact that Maine was an extremely agricultural state. You know, it was the breadbasket for New England. People like to say that Maine fed the Union Army in the 1800s. And we really were, you know, the center of agricultural production for everything from dairy to grain, potatoes to apples. Now, agriculture changed dramatically when food, as you mentioned in your introduction, you know, food is now shipped around the country and food has become much less regional. But as people have sort of looked towards this interest in buying more food locally or knowing more about what's in their food, or restaurants wanting to source things that are grown locally, people wanting to shop at farmers markets, all of it, you know, Maine was in the good position of having, frankly, a lot of underutilized farmland. And farms that, you know, where maybe the last generation was ready to turn it over, or somebody could get a slightly rundown farm for a reasonable price. And at the same time, we had some really great organizations out there to help people do it. Maine Farmland Trust has been really wonderful as an organization to help, retiring farmers turn their land over to younger farmers, or land to acquire a conservation easement that will keep it forever farming, but allow somebody to farm it more economically. We have an amazing tradition of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, which I was involved with in the beginnings back in the 1970s. But they're really just kind of a full service operation in helping people to find apprentices on farms when they want to give it a try. They have a journey person program, which is a longer year of study to help people who want to get into farming. They have workshops and just, you know, a newsletter and just all kinds of things that they do to help and support people. And I think a lot of this has just come together But as this market has grown, you know, we've had people who could sort of step into it, and we've got really great statistics in our state of being one of the few states where the average age of the farmer is going down or at least stabilizing, where in most states farmers are aging out and there's going to be a real shortage of farmers. We have more land coming into cultivation, where in most states it's going in the opposite direction. And we have a lot of groups that are really thinking about regional production, about how to, you know, grow more food locally, how to grow more in the region. New England, as we say in Congress, together is kind of like one big state. And I sort of see it as a, you know, you cross the borders to Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, even into Rhode Island. A lot of these things, you know, are really just working throughout the region. And a lot of people are really thinking about, you know, what could we do to make sure we're actually growing more of our food back here in New England. And I think it's just really been impressive and going well. And same with the fisheries. We have, you know, more and more fishermen who are trying to figure out how to, you know, deal with the ever-changing nature of the fisheries, but to sell more of their fish right off the boat, have, you know, things that look like a CSA that you'd have on a farm, only it's with fishermen, and, you know, some other novel ideas kind of looking into the future. So having had all this experience on my own, both as a farmer myself and working for the agriculture organization, I served in the state legislature and worked on these issues. It's just really nice when you come to Congress and sometimes are confronted with people who say, oh, you know, oh, little lady, you don't know anything about agriculture. That's not how we do it. You know, we grow 1,000 acres of soybeans and that's farming. But to be able to say, no, I represent a state where it's a significant part of our economy and it's growing. And, you know, agriculture is critically important to our rural economy. And, you know, it may be New England and we may do it differently, but it doesn't make it any less economically significant or any less, you know, important in the long run into, you know, how people get their food and how we eat. And the good news is, as I've spent 10 years in Congress, which is hard for me to realize I've actually even been there that long, but even in those 10 years, I've seen the difference. Between my first years on the Agriculture Committee, where people were, you know, more dismissive of organic farming, sustainable agriculture, local farming. Fast forward 10 years. I mean, this year or this session of Congress, I've had more Republican co-sponsors. And agriculture isn't always a partisan issue, but it's often regional. But, you know, now I work with people in Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, you know, big ag states where they're saying, yeah, but I've got, you know, I've got an organic market in my district for X, Y, or Z, or I've got a guy who raises beef, but then has 2 acres of greenhouse tomatoes that he sells to local restaurants. And it's really been wonderful just to see how much people are seeing this happening in their home districts around the country and parts of the country where I think there wasn't a big push for local or regionally grown food. There was much more of a commodity crop, let's ship it out of here. Kind of agricultural system, and I've seen that grow too. So I feel really good about what the perception is, how it's changing. We certainly haven't moved fast enough, and Congress is constantly, you know, behind in developing policy. But because the market is so strong, the market for organic foods is growing so rapidly, and we're not meeting the demand in this country to produce enough organic commodities to meet the demand of what consumers want to eat. It's been very useful to me in promoting policy ideas because I can say, hey, look, the market's out there. I'm not making this stuff up. And, you know, the USDA and congressional policy should reflect how do we assist farmers to be part of these good markets that give them better prices, allow them to, you know, stay away from toxic chemicals. They're obviously better for our environment, for our topsoil, for conservation. And I feel like we've had a fair amount of success. Doesn't always work our way, but I feel good about the way we've been moving in the last 10 years. And I just feel incredibly lucky to work on this issue because it's so fundamentally important in so many ways.
Yeah. I mean, Alan Savory defined it as the biggest impact on the future of humanity is looking at how we're going to manage our regenerative natural resources. And to your point, we've got a deficit where we require another 4 million acres of production to meet the current demand for organic food in this country. That is a strong economic play that casts what's going to happen with future generations and their desires at market for this differentiated food. And I do believe that New England, the Northeast, especially Maine, leading the way in fisheries and really all diversified crops coming from many of your farms, and also the research centers that you've built there, from GMRI to Wolf's Neck, that has defined a new opportunity where Maine seems to be, there's a concept in the innovation economy that's called the forced innovator, where great ideas come from people when they're forced to do this, when they need to do this, when they need to adapt. And when you have a 2-degree difference in your waterways in the Gulf of Maine now, and the effect on lobsters and other crustaceans and the loss of a cod fishery, well, you have to adapt, you have to evolve. And I praise you, and I praise all the folks from Maine for taking a lead step, for being the tip of the spear that I think can cast a larger shadow on our federal programs. So let me ask this, that you had mentioned you've been in agriculture for your entire life, and now you're involved, you're co-owner of Nebo Lodge and Restaurant with your daughter on North Haven. So when you're not in Congress fighting these larger battles, you're on the farm and working in the inn and the restaurant and giving a wonderful example of agrotourism, a destination in North Haven Island in Maine. How have you seen that program change since you've opened it? And maybe you can give a little more background about your experience in farming and food and what led you to create this.
Well, I think that's one of the most wonderful things that I have had the privilege of observing as our eating habits and you know, agricultural patterns have changed. I came to Maine in the early 1970s, and there was a back to the land movement. You know, like a lot of people had a copy of Helen and Scott Nearing's book called Living the Good Life, and it was all about, you know, living sustainably on the land. And that was the first Earth Day, the beginning of a lot of environmental thinking. I ended up going to College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, and Elliot Coleman, who's one of the sort of early gurus of organic farming, was one of my college teachers. So I was able to study organic farming, sustainability, and then actually was a Mosca farm apprentice and had a chance to start my own farm. When we had our first farm stand in about 1977, people were thrilled to be on an island and have a source of fresh food. But I don't think anybody came by and said, hey, is this organically grown? You know, what do you have any GMO seeds? What kind of pesticides have you ever used on this land? You know, we didn't get all those kind of questions. We just got, wow, your food tastes great, and we're glad you're growing it. If you fast forward today, 40 some years later, we run a farm stand. We have people come in there every day. We go to a farmer's market. We run a restaurant. And people come to our farm stand. They know all kinds of things about their food. They're interested in a whole variety of different foods. They want to know about our agricultural techniques. They want to know if we're certified organic. They want to know all those things. And the market has just exploded. So, you know, we didn't have any trouble selling our stuff in 1976, but today, you know, people will take a vacation to come to eat the food. And that's true, really. We're just one small example that shows what's going on all over the state of Maine and really all over about people's awareness about what's in their food. So, like I said, I got to study this in college. I was a farm apprentice. I've had a farm on and off since the early 1970s, and you know, had a chance to do everything from milk cows to chickens that we slaughtered on the farm to today we grow a lot of vegetables in greenhouses. We have a very short season on the coast. It's a saltwater farm, so June can be incredibly cool and wet. So we grow in 8 greenhouses, 5 of them are plastic hoop houses, and then 3 of them are heated greenhouses that we heat wood that we harvest on the island. and they operate year-round. So we have a year-round CSA. In the winter, we sell greens and, you know, some overwintered crops like parsnips and carrots. And then we put our tomatoes and warm weather crops in there early in the year so that we can start selling tomatoes in June and not have to wait till late August for everything to ripen on the farm. So that's part of, you know, our evolution. And also we have really combined it with the value added side of having, as you said, kind of like ecotourism. We run a 9-room inn and we have a restaurant that operates in the summer. And then one or two nights a week in the summer, we open up our barn and serve another 100 people in the barn. Some nights we're serving 300 people a meal. And we try to do as much as we can from the farm on our barn dinners. We give people a tour. We talk to them about how things were grown and the history of the farm that we operate in, which actually was first farmed in 1764. So it has a lot of history. But anyway, we're just one more example of how much people are interested in that and the opportunities that are out there. And people certainly love to come as part of their vacation, visit a farm, whether it's to see the animals or how we grow the crops, or just to eat wonderful food. It's a really big change from 40 years ago when people only expected to see, you know, iceberg lettuce and carrots and the celery in the grocery store. And now to the tiniest little market, to Walmart, you know, people want an organic selection. They want a whole variety of foods. They're trying new foods, and it's happening, you know, in a big variety of ways. We have a lot of farmers markets in the state of Maine, but also throughout the country. We've done a lot of work in our office with school lunch programs and getting more and more schools to have kitchens, to have school gardens, so kids can participate in the process from growing to composting, and also programs that make it easier for people who are dependent on SNAP benefits or other food, you know, subsidy programs to get healthy food, to learn more about cooking healthier food, and to make sure their families have a chance to, you know, have all the good health measures that you can have if you get a lot more fruits and vegetables in your diet.
Hmm. Yeah, let's jump in a little more. So in recent speaking engagement I saw of yours at the Stone Barn Center, you shared that 80% of the forthcoming 2018 Farm Bill will be funding SNAP, which is maybe some people note as the next iteration of food stamps. So obviously this represents a big political football within the impending midterm elections. So could you give us some additional detail about what that means for both our producers who may be awaiting the resources from the other 20% of that capital pool, and maybe just a quick informative blurb to our audience about how important nutrition, I mean, I think we all know nutrition is important for kids, but how important this program is for engaging families and kids in a preventative healthcare program.
Yeah, I mean, it is, unfortunately, it has become the political football of the Farm Bill. You're right about the huge percentage of the Farm Bill that's devoted to SNAP, or food stamps, we used to call them. And it is usually the thing that stops the Farm Bill from moving forward, whether it's the Republicans proposing big cuts in the dollar value or adding impediments to make it more difficult to access SNAP. And every once in a while, I just stand back and I think about this and say, we're talking about food. I mean, it's not like we're saying, should we have a program in this country that means everyone can have, you know, a snowmobile and a convertible Mustang or something. It's a necessity of life, and everyone should have access to fresh, healthy food and no one should go hungry. And we actually know that in virtually every state across the nation, there's a huge percentage of young people go hungry, senior citizens who are too proud or don't have the funds to get what they need. And we put a lot of stigma on having a food benefit program. We also, it is so restrained, the dollar value is so small, that for a lot of people with a family, they have to go for filling their shopping cart with the highest calorie food that will keep their family full, but maybe not healthy and growing. And we've tried to introduce measures into the Farm Bill and have gotten a couple of them in there that would just make it easier to acquire healthy food. We have this program that's called Double Bucks, or it goes under the name of Finney, but it says if you take your SNAP card to a farmer's market or a produce market and you use the dollars that you have on fresh fruits and vegetables, we'll give you double the amount. And that was a pilot program started by a wonderful group called Wholesome Wave. We were able to incorporate it into the Farm Bill and fund it. And now that operates in states around the country. And it's been wildly successful. And it reminds people that, you know, even if you don't have a little bit of money, you're still, you know, desperately hoping to get healthy food for your kids, but it's hard to do. We've been trying to introduce another program this year around produce prescription, we call it. We've started a caucus, which is kind of a loosely organized group of members of Congress who gather together on a topic. And we already have a hunger caucus that deals with hunger issues, but we started one, a little working group called Food is Medicine. And that really is, it's very bipartisan. We have both sides of the aisle. And we get together and hear speakers and try to work on policies that recognize the fact that food is a vital part of your health. So many of our bad health outcomes, from obesity to diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, are directly related to our diets and the food that we eat. And we're trying to change some of the policies and get more engaged in making sure that people have healthier food in their diet. And obviously, it's not something we're going to kind of regulate and say what you can eat every day. But there are a lot of ways, particularly in programs like SNAP or with people who are struggling to put food on the table, we can make it easier. One program that we're hoping to get a pilot of is also modeled after something that Wholesome Wave does, and that is a produce prescription. So if you are visiting your practitioner for a physical and they say, you know, you're just really not eating enough fresh fruits and vegetables, or maybe your young children aren't and they're already developing some of the signs of childhood obesity or other things that are becoming epidemic in this country, your practitioner can actually write you a prescription that you can translate then into a voucher to buy more healthy food. And in the research that Wholesome Wave has done, where they have these projects going on, they've seen amazing health outcomes in kids in particular who have access to more fresh fruits and vegetables and a better diet. And it's usually a financial issue that holds people back. I'll just say a little aside. I had a visit recently with someone from the Danish embassy. I'm very interested in Scandinavian countries and their food practices. And we were talking about a variety of programs in Denmark and some innovative things they were doing around food waste, which is another topic I very involved in and worked on. And it was right in the middle of one of our SNAP debates. And I said to the guy from the embassy who was very involved in food and agriculture issues, I said, what kind of program do you have in your country that would replicate, or how do you handle this, you know, this issue of people being hungry and making sure they get nutritious food? And honestly, he gave me this blank stare. And, you know, a few minutes later, or a few seconds later, he said, well, we don't have any programs to deal with hunger. It's not an issue in our country. And obviously they have, you know, a healthier economy and a whole variety of other things, but just try to imagine a country where we didn't assume that a percentage of our population would be hungry and that we would stigmatize them or maybe even punish them for that, or somehow say they were lazy or, you know, should pull themselves up by their bootstraps or get a job or whatever the numbers of things that we say in our horrendous debates. We just said, oh, well, food, that's a basic right. No one should go hungry. Why does someone go hungry in your country? It's really kind of unthinkable, but it's the era that we're living in, I'm sorry to say.
That's right. We're a work in progress, aren't we?
Yeah.
So, we had Michel Nichon on the podcast.
Oh, of course.
And he talked about some of those programs were just phenomenal. And we talked about the statistics of the people that need these things. It is jaw-dropping. And one of the lines that he gave in there, which I thought was fantastic, was to say, anybody in Congress that sits there and votes to take food off the table of kids is a jerk. I said,
right.
Yeah, that's,
right.
You know, I get it. Lost perspective for many. But yes, I agree. I think we have to We have to take a step back and appreciate what really is important and what our responsibilities are, what we have to do. And I think that's, again, your tip of the spear in leading the way of getting people to see this. And the more we can trigger people to do it for whatever rationale, whatever they need to do it, whether that's economically or for justice or whatever it may, whatever their driving factor may be, however we get there, that's a positive thing. So, and let me ask this.
I just throw in there, I mean, Michelle is great, and he and Gus Shoemaker really were the driving force behind Wholesome Wave, and so you know a lot of it. But I just want to say, we often benefit so much from nonprofit organizations like that who go out and raise the money, go out on a limb, test an idea, you know, kind of become the pilot project that we can't always move forward in Congress, but then give us the statistics and the facts to come back and say, look, this is already working. So why don't we make it part of our policy? And I'm really grateful for that. And the other thing I'm really grateful for is a lot of chefs today and people who work might work in high-end restaurants or, you know, have big visions in cookbooks have really seen the importance of engaging in public policy. And one of the best weapons or tools that I've gotten to work with in my 10 years in Congress have been the number of chefs who come down. They lobby Congress, they meet with people on both sides of the aisle, and, you know, everybody likes to eat, everybody has a favorite restaurant, and a chef from your hometown comes in and says, you know, we need to pay more attention to childhood hunger or getting healthy food on the table or organic food or sustainable fisheries. It makes an amazing difference, and it's, you know, one of the important parts of the political process is none of us do this alone, and we really, really need both active citizens, but also those engaged people who are willing to advocate for things that matter.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, chefs are a bit of our rock stars within the food system. And when you get leaders like Michelle, who comes out, launches programs like the Chef Boot Camp, which harmonizes and engages a lot of these, you know, chefs and these rock stars to have a voice and to focus that voice, I think that's a leading force. So the more we have these type of think tanks that you define, your caucuses that you're bringing together, where we can provide you the information you need to have a strong argument against some of maybe the crazy arguments coming from the other side, well, then fantastic. Let's we can work as a team. You had mentioned looking at some of the Scandinavian countries, and I know you travel around the world. I remember you did a trade mission down to Cuba when we first started the relationship, looking at organic production there. And I'm sure you've looked at other food systems, healthcare systems. I had a chance a couple years ago to travel to Europe as part of an Eisenhower Fellowship program, where I did an assessment on the Dutch model for reducing antibiotics in food animals and then their greenhouse production model. But I do know that you're also an Eisenhower Fellow. So maybe you could share with our audience a little bit about your experience with the Eisenhower Program, where you went, and maybe some things you took out of that.
Sure. It was actually quite a long time ago. I was a fellow in 97. And I was one of the first fellows, I think, who came from the political world. I was a state legislator at the time. In Maine, I was the Senate Majority Leader, and to tell you the truth, I don't think I had a passport. I don't think I had ever been out of the country besides Canada or Mexico, you know, crossing the border on a vacation or something. And I realized I was of course, I'd lived much of my life on a little island being a farmer and then becoming a state legislator. So I wasn't that worldly. But more importantly, I thought about it. I'd been in, you know, office for maybe 4 or 5 years then, working on state-based policy. And it hit me that I knew so little about the rest of the world, and I had never really experienced life. Certainly anywhere where I didn't speak the language. And I was lucky enough to go to Budapest. And it was right, not that many years, less than 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the, you know, dramatic changes that were happening in countries like Hungary. It wasn't the kind of crazy right-wing government that was there now. And but I really got an incredible experience getting to know women who were involved in the political process, women entrepreneurs, just to get to know the variety of parties from far right to far left. I actually had some meetings with the Minister of Agriculture and learned, you know, about some of the agricultural systems there. But more than anything else, it was an amazing experience for me as someone who worked in the public policy world, having no idea that I would someday be a member of Congress and actually really work on international issues. But just to feel what it was like to be, you know, literally somebody who didn't know the language. And I was lucky enough, as part of the Eisenhower Fellow Program, I had someone who worked with me during the day and translated. But, you know, when the end of the day came and we had our last meeting, I had to get on the train or the subway and cross over into Pest and get back to my apartment and open the door and go to the grocery store. And it wasn't a very English-speaking country. and that was just, you know, it was just really wonderful to experience that. And I even think back on it, you know, sometimes now, you know, just recently being on the Texas border and talking to these women who were detained in prisons and didn't speak English, didn't know half the time what somebody was telling them, you know, sign this legal document or say yes when I say yes, you know, when I tell you to, or, you know, all these other things. And the idea that, you know, most of us as Americans have very little experience in being foreigners. And that is to our detriment. And probably now more than ever, we could all use a trip out of the country to see, you know, what that's like. The other thing that was just great about being an Eisenhower Fellow those many years ago was getting to know the other people in the program. I was you know, in a single fellow program, so I didn't interact with anyone else in my 2 or 3 months there. But in the years since then, I've had the opportunity to host lots of Eisenhower Fellows for meetings or visits when they've either come to New England, or now virtually every year I get a group that comes to my office in Washington, you know, for who are here on all different purposes and you know, just have all kinds of interesting questions. I've also taken the opportunity. I don't ever get enough time to just travel for fun, which is a detriment of the job. But a few times I've been out somewhere and, you know, looked up in the directory and actually contacted somebody in a country where I'm visited and gotten the chance to just, you know, have this connection to a person who's also been through the program. And I've been, you know, hosted at a dinner in Turkey not that long ago with one of the early fellows, and visited with a judge in Northern Ireland, and, you know, just a few experiences like that, which I really cherish and feel very fortunate to have been a part of that network.
It is incredible, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think more folks need to travel out of the U.S. in a non-English-speaking country to experience what the rest of the world goes through, to be empathetic, to understand, to appreciate. And I too, I'm the other half of my fellowship was in Turkey, and it was during actually Erdogan's election back in end of 2015. That was a very interesting time to be there. I will say, completely to their credit, in an area, something that we all can all take with us as our midterms come up, during that election, 85% was the turnout to that election booth. So, you know, you ruffle a few feathers, just maybe Erdogan and the Fuhrer now, our Donald Trump, maybe will inspire us to come out and vote, because that's how we can take care of many of these biggest problems facing humanity is we can vote. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and that's exciting. So Congresswoman Pingree, can you please tell us a bit more about where we can find information on the Nebo Lodge, and maybe your site for our listeners can find some of the projects that you're working on?
Sure. Nebo Lodge and Turner Farm are our operations, and they're in North Haven, Maine, and you basically just Google them. And Nebo Lodge that we run was built in 1912, and I can't explain to anybody how it got that name, but it's been called that for over 100 years, and it's a fixture in our town. So if you Google that or the Turner Farm in North Haven, Maine, you can see everything about our business, our operation, how our farm is run, and how to come out to a barn dinner. We run a boat from the mainland in the evenings, so if people don't want to spend the night, they can come and go on a Coast Guard certified boat and just have dinner and have a wonderful trip back to the mainland afterwards. And we're also, for, you know, we hire farm apprentices every year, and this year we're working on a joint project with Johnson & Wales to have culinary interns who work a little bit on our farm and a little bit in our restaurant. So for people, or young people or people of any age who want to get some agriculture experience, it's really a wonderful place right on the ocean in a really interesting small community, and there aren't too many towns of 400 people anymore. So that in itself is a great experience, and I feel lucky to be a resident there. When it comes to agricultural policy, you can certainly go to our congressional website. We try to put up as much as we can about the bills we're working on. And, you know, I'm on the Agricultural Appropriations Committee, so we deal with the funding for every possible program at the USDA and oversight on everything from everything that you could possibly imagine, and also the battles around the farm bill. So we try to keep people updated on that. We even have a agricultural newsletter, and you could sign up and get a periodic newsletter that we send out via email. And I also think there are a lot of great organizations, and I can't give you too many websites off the top of my head, but the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition keeps track of the farm bill and a lot of agricultural policy. And another group that's fairly new called Food Policy Action does a scorecard of every member of Congress. So if you want to see how we vote and what issues matter, that's a good place to look, because it's often hard to figure out, which bills we're voting on and which particular amendments would have had an impact on something. But they sort through and find the 10 or 12 issues that are most important and give you a sense of people stand on agriculture, and I think that's a good way to learn more about it. And a lot of environmental organizations are increasingly interested in agricultural policy because it does have such a huge environmental impact. It has a huge public health impact, and so most people have environmental groups that they're attached to, and I think encouraging a lot of them to make sure that they're paying attention to agricultural issues, because it's not just air pollution we have to worry about. It's are we taking care of the land? Carbon sequestration is incredibly important. And if we had much more organic matter in our soil, which is an important part of organic farming, we would be sequestering a lot more carbon right now and probably having less of our climate change issues to worry about. So I think every environmental group should be focusing on both the public health and environmental issues around agriculture as well.
I do agree. I think it's the more we can all become engaged in systems thinking to know how all of this process work. And boy, if we really are environmentalists and care about how we're going to impact our kids and future generation, the way that you eat has some of the largest impact on the effect on the planet. So I just want to close by saying there's a great book called The Moderate Greatness, where author William Ofelis he clearly defines what the common factors that led to the fall of all great civilizations. It was hubris, it was greed and corruption and exorbitant power by a few, the riches that constantly funneled to the elite. And I would just say that it would be interesting for our Congress and especially the executive branch to read this short book, gain some perspective on what will happen if we continue to advance in the same type of direction. The elites that want to protect their riches, in fact, if we look at it pragmatically and keep their many chariots or those cheap feasts mm-hmm. that they have, they basically better wake up to that the fact that the pendulum swings back with fury to further bring us back into center. And you know, if history has proven time and time again that with the fall of each great empire, those making these short-sighted executive decisions won't be protected by those golden towers. So I think I just say thanks for all your great work and keep up the great work. And we look forward to supporting however we can from Sourcing Matters and myself. And I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me and for what you're doing and for the wonderful people that you've been telling their story via your podcast. And I'm absolutely going to read a copy of that book. I have a feeling it will keep me up at night, but I'm a little bit worried we're closer to that point than we would like to think.
Yeah, I know. Again, we'll stay positive, but at least we'll get more awareness behind it. So Congresswoman Pingree, thanks. Thanks again. I'll include links for everyone that you had mentioned at the tail end here, so our listeners have a place to dig deeper on the website. But again, I thank you for the conversation, and I look forward to speaking with you soon.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.